Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Rebecca Green.
And I'm Ben Clemmer. We'll open tonight's program examining the issue of gun violence. In the aftermath of the shooting in Parkland, Florida, the nation has watched a movement of young people calling for action to stop future mass shootings from taking place. A rally organized by a Fort Wayne college student was held earlier this month. WBOI's Zach Bernard was there to cover it. Zach caught up with Brandon Blumenhurst, president of Fort Wayne's College Democrats, and organizer of the gun rally. Their conversation began with a discussion on how the rally came to life.
The first thing I did was just making sure that I had all of the, what I would call the big event items in order. So finding a location, which was easy because the courthouse is available for everybody to use, or the courthouse green. The sound system was easy as well because I knew people that put on previous rallies, so they had good connections there. And then just making sure that we had a good speaker lineup that's ready to go so that we would draw people in who are passionate about that subject, and making sure that we had enough people there speaking to draw a big enough audience where it shows that we are all standing in solidarity against gun violence and mass school shootings. So once we got that all lined up, I put together a Facebook event page, and then I just invited people that I thought would be interested. I kept pushing for people to invite their friends, their family members, people who were passionate about the subject. And then from there, it was just continual media presence, press releases, making sure that we got enough momentum behind this to really start a movement here in Fort Wayne.
Looking back on the rally, did it live up to your expectations or fulfill the vision that you had for the rally as you were planning it?
I think it exceeded my expectations. I was gathering, I think, 200-ish people, 200, 250, and we were probably over 300, maybe closer to 400 or 500. So that was really cool to see that. I was pleasantly surprised with how many people showed up, but I think we had a really decent student population there as well. I wish we would have had more students there, but I think kind of moving forward, people seeing that this is a movement, there were students there, we have people behind this cause, I think we'll get, you know, more students there as we continue to fight for this, to solve this problem.
What kind of feedback did you get from the public in the hours and days after the rally took place?
It was pretty much all day, every day, just responding to people, thank you for coming, you know, stuff like that. It was really positive feedback from most people. You know, there are a couple people who had some negative comments, but majority of them were very positive and just thanked me for organizing this, putting this together, making sure that we started off strong in this fight to try and end these mass school shootings and gun violence. I think that we had 90-ish percent positive approval from everybody. A couple of people wanted some more student speakers and stuff like that, but nothing too crazy that people were complaining about or negative about.
One of the things that you mentioned at the rally and that you and I talked about following the rally was that you would be meeting with the president of College Republicans in Fort Wayne to sort of come together and make a statement on guns in a bipartisan fashion. That ended up getting some headlines following the rally. What's the status on that? Have you had any meetings, and what was discussed at those meetings?
So I actually met with Lewis Ostermeyer, and he's the president of Fort Wayne College Republicans, and their secretary, Caleb McCaig, on, I believe it was the Tuesday before spring break. And we just got together after class, really wanted to focus on things that we could come together and find a bipartisan agreement on. So I went in there with five items, and I came out of there with four that we agreed on. So that was a win in my book. Basically, we put together, so the four that got passed were requiring all gun purchases to use a universal background check, which would close the gun show loophole, allowing the CDC to study gun violence, and a requirement of states to input data into the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, which is not happening right now. There's also a bill that was introduced into the Senate by John Cornyn, I think it was in November of 2017. It's called the Fix Nix Bill, and that's essentially what it would do, just require states to input data into the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, but it hasn't been brought to a vote. And the last one is the banning of the sale, possession, or manufacturing of bump stocks, which was the item used in the Las Vegas shooting, which converted the semi-automatic weapon into essentially a fully automatic weapon.
Looking forward, what's next on your agenda? Do you have any rallies planned or any meetings planned in the future that focus on guns or anything else in particular?
As of right now, there is a March for Our Lives. It's going to be on March 24th on the courthouse green from 2 to 4 p.m. I'm not one of the main organizers behind it. It's actually two students from Homestead and Canterbury. So they were really passionate about the cause, and they decided to put together this rally. And I just said that I would play an advisory role and help them in whatever way they needed help. So they're organizing it right now. They're organizing the speaker lineup. Magnolia Keene is a sophomore at Homestead, and Sophia Ahmad is a sophomore at Canterbury. They're the two students that are putting the March for Our Lives event together. So I think it should be a pretty successful setup moving forward. I think that we'll continue to keep this in the news. That's kind of been my personal mission, just keeping this in the news until we see some action from our legislators. So I think we just got to keep it in the news, keep fighting, and, you know, whether that's hosting meetings or gun control advocates, gun rights activists, but bringing them together and saying, what can we do to help solve this problem? What can we do to help prevent some of these shootings from happening again? I think that's what we need to do moving forward, and I see a lot of community groups doing that now. I think it's AVOW, Advancing Voices of Women. They're bringing together Paul Helmke, who is the CEO and president of the Brady Campaign, and I forget the woman's name they're bringing in, but she designs purses where women can stow a handgun, I think it is. So they're bringing them together just to create a conversation, to create a dialogue, which frankly isn't really out there right now. There's no one talking to the other side, and I think that's what we have to do in order to move forward. Regardless of party affiliation, regardless of how you feel about guns, we have to start talking to do something about this problem.
That's all I have as far as my questioning is concerned. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
I just want to encourage people to come out to the March 24th rally. It should be a fantastic event full of students and community members that are just joining together in solidarity to create a dialogue again about how we can solve this problem and encourage our legislators to take action to help solve it.
Following the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida that left 17 dead, the national dialogue has stayed centered on guns. With many suggestions on how to combat gun violence from all ends of the spectrum, WBOI's Zach Bernard reports on an Indiana law that's earned national attention as a possible solution.
Say the police go to a residence for a domestic violence call. If officers determine one of the parties is a danger to themselves or others, they can take that individual's guns. Right there. When the dust settles, the owner gets a hearing in front of a judge to try and get their guns back. This is known as the Red Flag Law, which has gained national attention in the aftermath of February's mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, that left 17 dead. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham told CBS's Face the Nation Sunday that he would be introducing legislation resembling the measure later this week.
I hope the president will get behind this because it worked in Indiana, and that's where we're modeling our law off the Indiana law.
Indiana's red flag law was established in 2006 after an Indianapolis police officer was shot and killed by a man with schizophrenia. The shooter previously had his guns taken away before a hospitalization, but there was no law stopping him from getting them back after his release. Indiana is one of five states with this law currently on the books. Allen County has been applying the law since 2015. Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Adam Mildred says the New Haven Police Department was the first to apply the practice.
They had taken action, and they needed to file it with the court, wherein we prepared the document for the court's consideration, and it began the process.
Since 2016, Allen County has tackled an estimated 60 to 75 red flag cases. Critics of the law say it's too subjective and threatens the due process rights of the gun owner. On what grounds would an officer have to determine a gun owner is dangerous or unstable, and as a result, retain a legally owned firearm without a warrant? Mildred says the law walks a delicate line between public safety and individual property rights, but emphasizes that an individual's due process rights are protected at every turn.
The agency itself bears the burden of proof at all of the stages except the very last one.
Lieutenant Terry Mays has served on Fort Wayne's crisis intervention team since 2001. He says his team encounters these situations 5 or 6 times per year, and officers have to use their best judgment when they first decide to seize a firearm.
What we're looking for is that immediate threat, the imminent danger that someone poses to themselves or someone else, and do they have either a firearm readily available to them? Do they have it on their person at that moment, or is it easily accessible within the home? And if it is, then we are justified in taking it without a warrant.
Mildred says this determination by officers has to be justified in writing as an affidavit and filed immediately with the court, kickstarting the legal process. Allen County Superior Court Judge Fran Gull presides over most red flag cases. She says she reviews the affidavit and then determines whether or not to pursue further action.
If I find probable cause to believe that the person fits the statute's definition of a dangerous individual, I authorize the police to retain the weapons that were seized until further order of the court, and then I schedule it for an evidentiary hearing. Usually it's within about 2 weeks of the seizure.
The individual is notified of the evidentiary hearing and gets their day in court. The police department presents its information, while the gun owner makes their case on why they should have their firearms returned. Gull says as a human, she cares. That's why, once the case is resolved, she approaches each respondent with compassion, hoping they've received the help that they need.
I say, you know, you intersected with my world in the worst possible day of your life, and I'm concerned how you're feeling. What are you doing for your mental health? Are you taking care of yourself? And inevitably, they tell me, yeah, that was a really bad day. I was drinking a lot, or I was under the influence of drugs, but I'm talking to somebody now.
Since local law enforcement views red flag cases as civil and not criminal, many gun owners will see their firearms returned. What happens when Gold determines a person isn't quite ready?
I'm required to order the police department to retain custody of those weapons until further order. I also then notify the Indiana State Police that if they have any license to carry a handgun, that license be suspended until further order of the court.
Mildred also said the gun owner can agree to have the firearm sold by the county at auction, and the owner can receive no less than 92% of the profit from the sale. The police department and prosecutor's office agree the law has been effective since the county began applying it, but it hasn't existed without its obstacles. In 2013, Robert Reddington sued the state, alleging the statute was unconstitutional.
I'm not just talking about the United States Constitution. The Indiana Constitution also has specific protections for both firearm possession and also due process and equal protection property rights.
The law was upheld by Indiana's Court of Appeals, thus withstanding its only legal challenge to date. The court ruled that Reddington's due process rights were honored through the statute. With Graham citing Indiana's red flag law as the inspiration behind his national proposal, can this law be replicated at the federal level?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we're doing it here. There's no need for the federal government to reinvent the wheel. If they want to come look at our statute and look at our process, I'm a big proponent of don't reinvent the wheel if there's something out there that's working. And this is working.
I believe so. Any time that we can take that immediate threat, whether it be the individual and or a weapon they have access to, any time we can remove that immediate threat to someone else or themselves, it's got to be effective.
Mildred was slightly more conservative, saying states could easily implement these measures themselves without waiting on the federal government to do so. As far as Allen County is concerned, he says the law has been effective and assures residents that local police departments honor the delicate balance between public safety and individual property rights.
The officers are making contact with these folks in those circumstances with multiple objectives. One, this person needs to be safe. The people around them need to be safe. But also, there is no police officer that I know that takes those oaths that isn't a patriot. And they believe in the very Constitution that they're sworn to protect as well.
For WBOI News, I'm Zach Bernard.
Students speaking out against gun violence received support from many colleges in February. A number of Northeast Indiana universities will join a growing list of schools around the country that will not hold discipline for peaceful protests against the admission of a prospective student. In a statement Wednesday, Indiana University Purdue University Fort Wayne emphasized its commitment to creating an environment that enhances learning by recognizing the inherent worth of all individuals at the university. The University of St. Francis released a statement as well and posted the following at the top of its website's homepage. In light of the tragic events in Parkland, Florida, and the many planned protests throughout the country, the University of St. Francis supports young people's right to protest peacefully and will not consider disciplinary actions resulting from such protests as negative aspects of a prospective student's USF application. You are listening to WBUI Presents.
Conspiracy theories have become associated with mass shootings in recent years. Some claimed the Sandy Hook shooting didn't actually happen. Just this past month, the students who survived the shooting in Parkland, Florida, have also been under attack from conspiracy theorists. According to Dr. Joseph Usinski, who recently gave a presentation at Manchester University, conspiracy theories are for losers.
Okay, so that's the title of my talk, and that upsets a lot of people, and that's why it's the title of my talk.
Dr. Usinski opens his presentation by defining terms. Conspiracies are real. Powerful people are capable of terrible things, and conspiracies do happen. But there's a big difference between Watergate and a conspiracy theory, which might more closely resemble the moon landing being faked, President Obama being born in Kenya, or images of Ebola zombies being shared on social media. Why do people believe conspiracy theories? Dr. Usinski starts by asking an even broader question. Why do people believe anything? When people take in new information, they overlay it on top of what they already believe to be true. In a deeply divided country? Dr. Usinski says the most important predisposition people might have when considering conspiracy theories is political leaning.
Republicans and Democrats look at the world in such different ways, they come to very different conclusions even when the information is exactly the same.
What reinforces this is that people listen to their leaders. Supporters of President Trump listen to him and believe the things he says, just like supporters of President Obama take their cues from what he says and believes. One of the best examples of this played out during President Obama's first term. He was considering evolving his views on gay marriage. And at the time, the majority of African Americans did not support gay marriage. What happened next showed the power that leaders, or elites in a group, can have over their followers.
What people were asking was, well, will African Americans follow Barack Obama into the future if he comes out in favor of gay marriage? And what we found was, yes. They just changed their opinion on gay marriage to match what he said, rather than abandon him and keep their opinion.
Partisan predisposition can also impact issues that don't even relate to politics. During the 2012 presidential race, Republicans had a much more favorable view of the company Godfather's Pizza because of the company's association with then-presidential candidate Herman Cain. After examining how people follow their leaders, Dr. Usinski asked the audience members who they picture when they think of a typical conspiracy theorist. Many in the audience agreed they picture someone white, male, middle-aged, and with a conservative leaning. Dr. Usinski's data shows this isn't true.
Conspiracy thinking cuts exactly evenly across gender, across race, age,
and political leaning. Conspiracy theorists can come from all sides, and this has been apparent over the last 120 years. For his research, Dr. Usinski has examined 120,000 letters to the editor written into the New York Times, 1,000 letters a year, going back 120 years. Today, conspiracy theorists tend to be independent, poorer, and they don't participate in systems that they think are rigged. This means they won't invest in the stock market. They likely won't donate money to political candidates, and following that trend of non-participation, they typically won't vote either. There has always been some presence of conspiracy theories spread throughout history, and they usually would come from groups of people who don't have power.
So my basic argument is this, in that conspiracy theories are used by vulnerable groups, you know, which I will term losers, to help manage their perceived danger. These fears are fundamentally driven by shifts in relative power, and so because defeat and exclusion are the biggest inducements, conspiracy theories are for losers.
Defeat and exclusion are part of the pattern of conspiracy theories throughout history. When President Obama was in office, the conspiracy theories came from Republicans and focused on his background and his policies. During President George W. Bush's time in office, conspiracy theories came from Democrats and were about the Iraq War and 9/11. That pattern goes back decades. The party out of power, with supporters afraid of what the future might bring, is more likely to spread conspiracy theories. Looking back through Dr. Yersinsky's 120,000 letters to the New York Times shows trends in who people fear. Conspiracy theories from Democrats are typically directed at conservatives and corporations. Republicans historically fear liberals and communists, and those percentages are all almost equal.
Who are they accusing of conspiring? So we have all of our conspiracy letters. Equal number accuse the right and the left and capitalists and communists of conspiring. The biggest enemy that people tend to identify is foreigners.
The chart that was projected over Dr. Yersinsky's head shows that the bias against foreigners is 20% higher than any bias against political groups. This bias translated into political positions during the 2016 election, in a race that brought unprecedented levels of conspiracy theory politics. Dr. Yersinsky lists some of the conspiracy theories used by Donald Trump in his run for the White House.
I don't think there was a conspiracy theory that he didn't like, and this is a list of all of them. The birth certificate, the college transcripts, foreigners, the FBI, 9/11, Ted Cruz's dad.
This could all be summed up in one statement. Political elites had sold out the interests of regular Americans to foreign interests. And that was President Trump's argument. He got conspiracy theorists who don't typically vote to go to the polls. But Trump wasn't the only candidate Dr. Yersinsky blames for conspiracy theory politics.
On the opposite end, you had Bernie Sanders, who was running a slightly tighter campaign because he had one clear conspiracy theory. And that involved the 1%.
Conspiracy theorists often believe that systems are rigged against them. Senator Bernie Sanders used the word rigged in almost every speech he gave on his campaign. Conspiracy theories do usually surround elections much closer to November. But the 2016 race even impacted whether or not people thought the race itself would be rigged. In races past, like 2012, some people surveyed in both parties thought the race would be rigged before votes were cast. This was split almost exactly even between Democrats and Republicans. President Obama defeated Governor Mitt Romney, and then people were asked whether they thought the race was rigged. Fewer Democrats thought it was rigged. Their candidate won. But more Republicans were willing to believe the conspiracy theory that the race was rigged given the outcome. Whether or not the race could be rigged was an issue of the 2016 campaign. Dr. Yersinsky's data showed that the same percentage of people in both parties thought the race would be rigged, just like 2012. After the race, the data showed a drop in Republicans who thought the race was rigged because President Trump won, but the number of Democrats who believed there was fraud didn't go up. Secretary Hillary Clinton and other Democratic leaders had said the race wouldn't be rigged. Later, both of these percentages would change, as President Trump made claims about people voting illegally, and the Russia investigation began to pick up steam.
You know, a lot of people are able to come to power with conspiracy theories, but it's a very slippery slope because you have to keep people in a constant state of fear, always thinking there's an enemy that we have to fight.
Conspiracy theories haven't faded since the 2016 election. Dr. Yersinsky says they can be hard to combat. People who typically don't believe them can become inoculated for them by knowing what conspiracy theories might look like. A quick fact check might be all that is necessary to realize the Ebola zombie is actually an extra from World War Z. It can even be hard to get a conspiracy theorist to stop believing in a conspiracy theory with proof.
You know, when they get the information that answers it and shows that they're wrong, they then change the goalposts. So this is a very good case in point, is that they said Obama doesn't have a birth certificate. So he came out with his birth certificate. And they said he doesn't have the long form birth certificate. He brings out the long form birth certificate. And they say, well, that's forged. So in this instance, you were never able to win and convince them.
Conspiracy theories in America have been around for centuries, going back to the days when towns killed women accused of being witches. Today, conspiracy theories make up a significant portion of our political discourse. And while the targets and topics will vary, they remain a way for people who are afraid or feel powerless to fight a perceived threat. Conspiracy theorists may never change their opinions and beliefs, but as political power shifts and changes hands over time, some conspiracy theorists won't always be on the losing side. For WBOI News, I'm Ben Clemmer.
Coming up on WBOI Presents, we'll catch up with Araceli Gomez Aldana, looking back at her coverage of public health and domestic violence.
And later on in the program, WBOI's Julia Meek sits down with Miles Fulwider from the University of St. Francis and Cassie Beer from Rosalind in the Way to talk about Marble Lounge Records, Stay with us.